The latest novel from the author Louise Erdrich is a not-so-typical coming-of-age story. It's called The Roundhouse, and it takes place in the 1980s, and it's all about Joe Counts. At first, Joe's your average 13-year-old kid, worried about having the coolest sneakers and reciting lines from his favorite sci-fi TV show with his friends. But Joe's world is turned upside down when his mom, Geraldine, is attacked and raped, as described in this scene from the novel, when Joe sees her for the first time at the hospital.
"Now I saw my mother's face, puffed with welts and distorted to an ugly shape. She peered through slits in the swollen flesh of her lids. 'What happened?' I asked stupidly. She didn't answer. Tears leaked from the corners of her eyes. She blotted them away with a gauze-wrapped fist. 'I'm all right, Joe. Look at me. I'm all right, see?' And I looked at her, but she was not all right."
And because she's not all right, and because Joe will do anything for her, Joe grows up fast. For decades, Louise Erdrich has chronicled life on American Indian reservations. The Roundhouse takes place among a tight-knit community of Ojibwe in North Dakota. And in this story, a complicated legal system sets the scene for the drama after Joe's mother is attacked, as Erdrich explained to us recently.
"This catapults him into an adulthood. He's not ready for this, but it throws him into a set of responsibilities that no 13-year-old should have to bear. And as the book goes on, as he sees that the adults cannot find justice, it becomes clear to him, and then it becomes clear to his best friend as well, that they may have to seek justice on their own."
To talk more about what stymies the adults in this story from seeking justice, give us an idea of what was happening in the late 80s that made it difficult for victims of sexual assault on reservations to seek justice. Because in the early pages, you know, one of her husband's first questions is not necessarily who had done this to her, but where.
"Well, there are several kinds of land on reservations. And all of these pieces of land have different entities who are in charge of enforcing laws on this land. So in this case, Geraldine Counts does not know where her attacker raped her. She didn't see, she doesn't know. So in her case, it is very, very difficult to find justice because there's no clear entity who is in charge of seeking justice for her."
And it makes it all the more painful, of course, because her husband is a tribal judge. He's intimate with the law.
Exactly. Exactly. So in writing the book, the question was, if a tribal judge, someone who has spent his life in the law, cannot find justice for the woman he loves, where is justice? And the book is also about the legacy of generations of injustice and what comes of that. Because, of course, what comes of that is an individual needs to seek justice in their own way when they can't find justice through the system. And that brings chaos.
And the question of revenge is a topic that you've come back to repeatedly over the years in your work. And I didn't know what draws you to it and or what you're learning about it as you write.
Well, thanks for that question. You know, I am learning something about it, and I think it drew me to law and what its meaning is for Native American people. The law is the basis of existence in many ways because reservations and even our status within the United States makes us legal entities because the original way tribal people were recognized was through treaties. So I've thought about it quite a lot and why revenge is the only form of justice in some locations and in some terrible situations.
Though I feel, looking at your work, that the answer is that it's not entirely as satisfying as one might think once you've
revenge?
Gotten that revenge. Yeah.
No, revenge is a sorrow for the person who has to take it on. And the person who is rash enough to think it's going to help a situation is always wrong.
Louise Erdrich speaking about her new novel. It's called The Roundhouse.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Let me give you a sentence from a novel. The first sentence of the new novel from crime writer Dennis Lehane. Some years later, on a tugboat in the Gulf of Mexico, Joe Coughlin's feet were placed in a tub of cement. Pretty dramatic, though Lehane met a man for whom it was not quite enough.
It was funny. A guy came up to me the other night, and he said, I really loved this once it got going. I thought, Jesus Christ, you read the first sentence. How much more getting going is it going to get?
Dennis Lehane is famous for crime novels that became movies like Mystic River, Gone Baby Gone, or Shutter Island. They are contemporary stories for the most part. His new book, Live by Night, reaches farther into the past, the era of prohibition, bootleggers, and an early brand of gangsters. Why write about the 1920s in this particular slice of the 1920s?
The short answer is that I've always absolutely loved the time period. It's probably my favorite time period in American history. Anything between the two world wars. The clothes and the cars and Tommy guns and maybe too much exposure to 1920s and 1930s gangster movies when I was a kid.
But with that said, is it also that you're a crime writer and this is a period where crime is romanticized and also, historically speaking, you know, organized crime as we know it got organized?
Yes, that was, I mean, it was certainly interesting to me to see, to look at the seeds and the growth of what we understand now as the American Mafia. This is usually considered the end of the independent operator decade. That to me was fun to look at.
Although I was also thinking about the challenges of being a writer and delving into this period. You found an original story to tell, but I wonder if it's a challenge because we're so surrounded. We all sort of know this gangster story on one level or another. We know the backdrop anyway. Is it challenging to get away from the constant exposure to this topic and find what you really think about it and what story you want to tell?
Absolutely. I wrote the first two chapters of Live by Night and felt good about them, but said, what am I bringing to the table that's different? Because then along comes Boardwalk Empire. Then there's a sense of, okay, now it's back in the vogue, and we're still seeing the story that, you know, we're still seeing whiskey. We're still seeing the whiskey trade. And so I said, I'm just going to wait until I find the right story. And it was about a year and a half later that I went to see a friend in Ybor City in Tampa, near where I live. I live in Tampa and in Boston. And I was early, and it was a Sunday morning, and I was walking around the streets of Ybor. And now most of Florida, a building gets so much as a paint peels, and they knock it down and put up a Hooters. But in Ybor, they've just kept it completely preserved. And it looks exactly like it did back in the 1910s, 1920s, as long as you remove the cars. And that was when I flashed on it. I just went, wait a minute, they used to bring rum in here. They used to bring it up through tunnels, which is insane because it's at sea level. They used to build tunnels under these buildings and let them flood. And I thought, that's it. It's rum. The thing that nobody has been doing is rum.
We should tell people who haven't read the book yet that although it begins in Boston and there are references to Charlestown, which you've written about so many times before and so well, there's a move. The character moves to Tampa. He ends up in Ybor City, and that's where the latter part of the novel takes place.
Yeah. The rum route, if you will, was from Havana across the Florida Strait in through Tampa. So my idea was, let's do the rum route in reverse. I'm going to do Boston, and then I'm going to go to Tampa, and then I'm going to go to Havana. I wanted to take this guy who was very northern, put him in a very southern, very Latin setting, and see how he responded.
Let's talk about the main character here. Joe Coughlin is his name. He's a very young man when we start out here. As we go along, we find that he is a crook, but he's got certain standards, things he wants to do, things he doesn't. And in fact, later in the book, there's a guy who says to him, "You're not a killer, Joseph," which is a problem. Who is he?
Well, he's living with a little bit of a myth. He thinks he can navigate these waters and remain an outlaw without becoming a gangster. But as the book progresses, it becomes very clear you cannot be an outlaw without becoming a gangster, not in this trade, not in this time period. So that becomes one of, I think, part of Joe's journey is a sort of journey to overcome his own self-delusion.
I wonder if I can get you to read from page 144. there's almost a little speech that Joe gives to his brother here, in which he lays out his sort of romantic notion of what a gangster is.
All right. You buy into all this stuff about good guys and bad guys in the world. A loan shark breaks a guy's leg for not paying his debt. A banker throws a guy out of his home for the same reason, and you think there's a difference. Like the banker's just doing his job, but the loan shark's a criminal. I like the loan shark, because he doesn't pretend to be anything else. And I think the banker should be sitting where I'm sitting right now. I'm not going to live some life where I pay my taxes and fetch the boss a lemonade at the company picnic and buy life insurance, get older, get fatter, talk about my squash game and my kids' grades, die at my desk, and they'll already have scraped my name off the office door before the dirt's hit the coffin.
Mm. Now, when we read that in 2012, there are several layers to it. First is the reference to bankers being no better than gangsters. I assume that was intended.
Well, I believe that's very much an attitude that was very prevalent during the Great Depression. That speech is, I think, given about a month before the Great Depression was about to hit. But, yeah, of course, I think there's the attraction of the gangster myth is that it's capitalism laid bare. And so we see these guys who are doing all the terrible things that we believe that a lot of corporate America are doing, but at least they're upfront about it. And so while that is maybe splitting hairs, I think there is something slightly more admirable about Joe Coughlin than, say, you know, the guys who rigged the system so that they could kick people out of their homes, they could destroy businesses, they could lay waste not only to this country but to the globe back in 2008.
Do you feel like in some ways the 1920s were a better time?
I don't know if they were better. I didn't live there, but they were cooler. everybody smoked and didn't know it was bad for them. And it was a time where I think there was some sort of ignorance of bliss. You also had a time in which the entire country turned against the law of the land, which had to make it fun. I mean, think how much fun it was to contact a friend and say, we're meeting in a speakeasy tonight. Here's the password.
You know, the last time that we talked on this program, we were talking about a real-life Boston mobster, Whitey Bulger. And you talked then about the romantic allure of the gangster image. But you also talked about how that image is a fraud, and that particularly in Bulger's case, he was a heroin trafficker in the housing projects that he supposedly protected.
Was protecting, yes. Yeah.
Did you worry about romanticizing crime as you wrote this novel?
No, I was raised far too Catholic to think I'm gonna write a gangster book in which the gangster gets out scot-free. And it's very early in the book that his father says to him, violence procreates violence. And the children of your violence, metaphorically speaking, are going to come back for you. So I knew the book was heading down that path. I also knew that it was going to be about the love of the genre, not necessarily the love of gangsters.
Dennis Lehane's latest novel is called Live by Night. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
And you can read or download audio of an exclusive section from Live by Night at NPR Books, part of our new First Read series at nprbooks.org. You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News. Many people who read a lot have gotten used to reading on screens, on laptops, on tablets, e-readers, lying in bed, flipping your thumb across the screen of the phone. Some people say they prefer that to the experience of reading a heavy, awkward print version of a book. But every now and then a book comes along that just seems to insist on being physical. Something about it just can't be transferred to the screen. NPR's Lynn Neary came across such a book among the many that pile up on her desk every day.
It showed up in a big box of children's books, all brightly colored and many beautifully illustrated. But this one stood out. To begin with, this was a new version of The Odyssey, aimed at kids 8 and up. But the artwork seemed sophisticated for a children's book. These were not your standard depictions of gods and goddesses with chiseled features and flowing gowns. The images were stylized and a little edgy, multi-layered and richly colored. It seemed like a book that might appeal to adults as well as children. A perfect book, perhaps, to read with a child. Would a book like this, I wondered, ever make sense as an e-book?
We feel that the book is a nearly perfect technology as it is, and this is why it's been around for so long.
Karen Lotz is president and publisher of Candlewick Press, which published The Odyssey in this country. Candlewick specializes in children's books, and like all publishing companies, now it releases books in both electronic and traditional book form. But Lotz says some books, The Odyssey is one of them, seem destined for print. She says that decision is made at the very beginning of the process.
If you're thinking about a book in its early stages, you're almost always imagining what it's going to be like and what it's going to feel like. And I think we're coming into a time where we as publishers do that digitally as well. We think about something in a digital form, but if it's going to insist on being physical, it means it's going to be lavish, beautiful, tactile, something to linger over.
Lott says at Candlewick they strive to make every book beautiful, but a few fall into a category they think of as their specials line. They are books that might make good gifts or that they imagine will have a long life on someone's library shelf. A team of editors, art directors, and designers lavish attention on these books.
We're all obsessed, actually, with books, with paper quality. We've gone so far on certain of our titles to invent colors that never existed before. And that's the type of detail that we're into. And we love working with the artists and figuring out what their dream would be of the ideal form, and that kind of collaboration is incredibly exciting.
The artist behind The Odyssey is Neil Packer, who has also illustrated collector's editions of some well-known novels, including Catch-22 and 100 Years of Solitude. Packer says he began working on The Odyssey 6 years ago, well before most people had ever heard of e-books.
It was very much conceived, obviously, as a tactile and physical thing. You know, I work pigment on paper, and that's how the things start, and that's probably how they are best represented. For me, I like the tactility of a book and the fact that one can have it as an object of beauty, almost an ornament.
Packer says he would be interested in exploring what he could do with digital technology, but he believes if a book is going to be viewed on the screen, the artwork needs to be conceived that way. He says transferring artwork from the pages of a book like The Odyssey to an electronic device doesn't really work.
I don't think sort of turning it into an electronic book would actually do anything to it. It wouldn't bring anything to it. The problem is with picture books, when you sort of put them on a screen, they sit there rather awkwardly. They don't actually do anything. And I think the temptation for publishers is then to often add animations to them and open up discussion forums and that sort of thing. And it's, again, it doesn't take them anywhere.
Of course, illustrations alone do not make a book, especially The Odyssey.
The book was conceived as a whole, words and pictures together. They're not separable.
Gillian Cross wrote this version of The Odyssey. She views the book as a stepping stone, a way in for young people who are likely to read the original when they get older. Cross says she can't imagine this Odyssey in ebook form.
I've known all along it would be impossible for it to be an ebook with the current state of the technology. There's no way that the technology could cope with what the pictures are, with their richness and their vitality.
Cross has nothing but admiration for Packer's artwork, but she does disagree with him on one point. The beauty of a book is one reason to treasure it, Cross says, but she also thinks a book should be viewed as more than a work of art that sits on a shelf. If it's regarded as nothing more than an ornament, she worries it will be marginalized, and readers of the future will never understand all that a physical book offers.
With anything digital, even upon your e-reader, there'll be another book, or on the internet there'll be another link you can click on. The fact that a printed book invites you to close it, and that it has been specially designed so that the shape of this book might be unique. The shape of The Odyssey is quite interesting, isn't it? And the weight of it in your hands. All these things, I think, have value in that they invite you to reflect on what's inside the book.
Not all books are the same. Some, like encyclopedias and paperbacks we pick up while traveling, navigate easily to the screen. But some books hold a special place in our hearts. Often, says Karen Lotz, they are the books we first encountered as children.
People tend to remember the books that they had when they were children as physical objects. They remember what the book felt like in their hand, where it sat in their room. They take it under the covers at night. They take it outside to read under a tree. It's a very precious object. It gets some power over us as we read it. It sort of becomes part of us, and we become part of it in a very interesting way.
The technology of e-books is still developing, says Lotz. Eventually, it may be possible to reproduce visually rich, highly designed books onto a screen in a way that is as satisfying as a physical book. But even when and if that day arrives, Lotz believes there will always be a place for both. And there may also always be books that just don't need to go digital. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
From NPR News, this is Morning Edition, produced by Nishant Dahiya and Nicole Beemsterboer.
Our senior producers are Cindy Carpian and Barry Gordimer. Our senior supervising producers are Kara Tallow and Tracy Wall.
Our executive producer is Madalika Sika. The executive editor of news programming is Ellen McDonald. Morning Edition's theme music was written by B.J. Lederman and arranged by Jim Pugh. I'm David Green.
Renee Montaigne is back with us next week. I'm Steve Inskeep.
March 13, 1963, the Cold War chills the world. The U.S. is drawn deeper into Vietnam. The communist government in Cuba is proving to be a thorn in the side of the American hemisphere. The struggle for civil rights marches across the landscape, and the President of the United States calls an old friend to express outrage and concern.
Dave?
Yes, how are you?
How are you?
Dave, I noticed in the paper this morning where the Swedish team beat the American hockey team 17-2.
Yeah, I saw that.
Christ, who are we sending over there? Girls?
I know, they haven't won a game.
I know it. I mean, who got them up?
I don't know. I can check into it.
Almost 50 years later, the John F. Kennedy Library Foundation is releasing a new trove of secret recordings made inside the Kennedy White House. A new book, which includes over 260 hours of transcribed conversations from inside the White House, along with 2.5 hours of audio recordings, has been published this week. Listening In, the Secret White House Recordings of John F. Kennedy. They are selected and set in context by Ted Widmer, director of the John Carter Brown Library, and the book includes an introduction by Caroline Kennedy, who joins us from New York. Thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
I dare say a lot of people think Richard Nixon brought recording technology into the White House. We have learned over the years it dates back to, I think, at least Franklin Roosevelt. But how and why was President Kennedy recording conversations?
Well, we're not really 100% sure why he installed the recording. The best guesses are, one, that he himself was such a lover of history and he really wanted to have an accurate record that he could draw upon later for his own memoir. And I think the second is also, after the Bay of Pigs, he knew who had said what, and they changed their tune afterwards. And he wanted to really be able to go back and keep people honest, make sure that he had an accurate record of what was said when he was facing these difficult crises.
Well, that brings up a clip of audio we wanted to listen to next, October 16, 1962, before the rest of the world knew about the Soviet attempt to put defensive missiles in Cuba. There's photographic advisors meeting with President Kennedy, and let's hear how this audio begins. I guess that's you.
I guess that is.
How's that feel, to hear maybe less your voice than your father's, the warmth in his voice?
It's wonderful for me to have these recordings because they give me a sense of him at work. And I think all kids wonder what their parents do all day long. And this is really a wonderful way of listening into that. I mean, obviously I have other memories, but I do remember going over to the office and he always seemed really glad to see us. And I think that really comes through.
To a degree that I hadn't appreciated, these recordings suggest that President Kennedy kept in touch with his predecessors, President Eisenhower, Truman.
Hello.
Hello, this is Harry Truman.
Hello, how are you, Mr. President?
Was it simple courtesy or something else?
Well, I think you can hear that there's more to it. I mean, I think the conversations with President Eisenhower about the Cuba Missile Crisis are illuminating, and certainly as a military hero, icon, leader, he had a lot of wisdom to share with my father about the behavior of the Russians and his insight into that. So I think it was courtesy, but I think it was also very valuable.
Hello? General, how are you? Oh, fine. General, I just wanted to bring you up to date on this matter because I know of your concern about it.
Another conversation of which the audio isn't included, but I made some notes about it. March 4, 1963, President Kennedy and the Attorney General, Robert F. Kennedy, your uncle, of course. It's not high-minded, but these are two sharp-eyed professional Pauls, kind of fetching. what do you hear in their relationship in that?
Well, I think they had a conversation with no beginning and no end. I think they really were just so incredibly close. They were close professionally. They were looking out for each other. My Uncle Bobby obviously was my father's campaign manager, closest advisor, not only on civil rights, which was certainly the most important domestic issue that he faced, but on Vietnam and in the Cuban Missile Crisis also. So I think that what you really hear are people who loved each other, worked together, made each other laugh, and really trusted each other.
Some audio to hear that I'm not even going to characterize it. Private dictation, President Kennedy on November 4, 1963. He's recollecting the fact that he feels that he allowed a coup in South Vietnam to take place to overthrow Ngo Dinh Diem, the leader of South Vietnam, and his brother Nguyen. They died in that coup. And listen to President Kennedy.
I was shocked by the death of Diem and Nguyen. I'd met Diem with Justice Douglas many years ago. He was an extraordinary character. While he became increasingly difficult in the last months, nevertheless, over a 10-year period, he'd held his country together, maintained its independence under very adverse conditions. The way he was killed made it particularly abhorrent.
What do you make of that, and what do you hear in President Kennedy's voice?
Well, I hear regret, remorse, uncertainty, dissatisfaction with his own performance, and I think that really led to a real reevaluation of Vietnam in his mind.
May I ask, do you ever listen to this audio just to hear it?
No, I haven't really done that. I mean, I've heard a lot of it over the years, and so I obviously am interested in it. I was really interested in what my children thought.
May I ask what your children thought?
Oh, they think it's great. They really found this book to be engaging and so interesting because I think it really gives a sense of who he was informally, formally, at work, kidding around. And so I think that they really felt that this helped connect them to their grandfather.
Caroline Kennedy. She's written the introduction to a new book, which includes audio recordings, Listening In, the Secret White House Recordings of John F. Kennedy. Ms. Kennedy, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Melissa Block. The cursing mommy likes her scotch and a martini or four and a full bottle of Kahlua consumed in the afternoon while soaking in a steaming bathtub, ignoring the knocks of her children locked outside. Along with her dubious parenting skills, the cursing mommy has no shame, and she swears an extremely blue streak. She's the flagrantly unpolitically correct creation of the New Yorker writer and humorist Ian Fraser, out with his very funny first novel, The Cursing Mommy's Book of Days. Ian Fraser, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me.
Let's talk about this character, the cursing mommy. She first started appearing in your columns in The New Yorker, and now she has a whole book. It's her diary of 1 year of trouble. Why don't you describe this character, the cursing mommy?
Well, the cursing mommy is very serious, and she wants to do the right thing, and she wants to do what is expected of her. And she starts out generally, almost always, with a very good intention, but then something goes wrong, and then she just totally blows up and just screams and yells and curses. That's sort of her character. And then she recovers, you know, and then she's like, wow, what was I thinking? But she's mercurial in that way.
And when she does go on these cursing jags, which is often, she inevitably ends up blaming the Bush administration.
Yeah, she's still really hung up. She belongs to a book group, and every couple weeks they read another book about how terrible the Bush administration was. And so she knows all these Bush administration people, and their names sometimes almost substitute for curse words in her rants.
Well, let's give a sense of this. We're going to be bleeping liberally here. This is one scene when the cursing mommy is vacuuming, and the vacuum scoops up her house coat.
The cursing mommy is doing her cleaning today in a comfortable old floor-length housecoat that used to be Grandma Pat's. And I swoop the suckmore right at my feet and, no, the machine inhaled the hem of my housecoat. Let go, you thing. Where the hell is the off switch? Machine has inhaled the housecoat up to my knee. I'm yanking and ripping the fabric. Piece of dangerous vacuum cleaner. The incompetence of the Consumer Safety Bureau under the Bush administration, whoever they were, that let this ouch dangerous piece of be sold. Ari Fleischer, that vacuum cleaner deregulating. Now I'm wrestling with the vacuum cleaner on the floor. Everything. Rip, tear, putt, putt, click.
Ian Fraser, you channel that voice for alarmingly well.
Well, my wife wants me to say that the cursing mommy is me.
Not her.
She's the patient and calm one. I did used to kind of put on a house coat and and slippers and just sort of lounge around and say, get your own lunch, you know. It's kind of a love of a Phyllis Diller type of character, you know.
The cursing mommy has a family.
Right.
And it's just a heap of trouble. She's got one son who breaks out in hives and faints all the time. Another who's a pyromaniac and takes all kinds of medication, including one that's called an anti-arsenic. And her husband, Larry, who's a frequent weeper and collects capacitors fill the house.
And the cursing mommy is always tripping over these boxes of capacitors. They fill the basement. And he goes to capacitors conventions and stuff. And honestly, I don't know what a capacitor is, but it just sounds like something that maybe you would collect. I don't know. He collects like World War II era capacitors and Soviet made capacitors. And that's sort of where he's sort of off in that area. That's sort of where he is. And the cursing mommy is actually dealing with things like, you know, the garage burning down and stuff like that while Larry is otherwise occupied with his capacitors.
Have you had people come up to you and say, I recognize myself in the cursing mommy. I don't want to, but that is me.
Oh, yeah. It happens all the time. I mean, it's sort of it's like a trend. It's something that happened in history that, for example, my grandmother, I don't think I ever heard her curse. And my mother might curse occasionally, but nothing beyond the mildest of curse words. And I think in our generation, I mean, I'm of the baby boom generation, suddenly everybody cursed. Men, women, children. I mean, but women cursed in a way, I think, that they didn't. So I think maybe a lot of people, they do it, and then they feel a little bit like, am I supposed to be doing that? But it's just what happened, you know? It's just part of how things changed.
Would it be as funny, do you think, if the cursing mommy were not a mommy, if it were a male character?
Oh, if it was like the cursing state, you know, whatever, dad?
Yeah.
No, it wouldn't be funny. Cursing dads are terrifying. I don't know why, but no, it just doesn't seem to me like that would be funny. I mean, it might be you could try it and see. I suppose anybody just losing it and sputtering curses is pretty funny.
Is there any pattern to where you find things that are funny, things that strike you as funny?
I think what is important for things to be funny is if you, the listener or the reader, get a chance to supply the humor of it yourself. That is, if the person telling you the thing does not know it's funny, it's your joke, you know? It's like, I remember years ago there was an official named Admiral John Stufflebeam. And he used to come out, now Admiral John Stufflebeam, we'll talk about such. And nobody ever said, this guy has a funny name, you know. and to me, I always enjoyed when Admiral Stufflebeam came out because, you know, I felt like, wow, I know that's funny. And Admiral Stufflebeam probably doesn't, or maybe he does. He just doesn't want to make anything of it.
If you're walking around and you find or hear or see something that you think is funny, are you a note taker? Are you scribbling that down, or will you remember?
Yeah, I go back and write it down.
You
immediately.
Do,
yeah.
And what will that note look like?
Well, for example, I was walking in the park near my house, and a muffin fell out of the air and landed upright on the path in front of me. And I just, my God, that was incredible! A muffin fell out of the sky, and what was even more amazing, it didn't bounce or anything, and it landed exactly in presentation, just exactly like a muffin right in front of me. And I just thought, that is the most amazing thing. Well, I looked up and hunted around the tree, and finally I found way up there was a blue jay that was looking over. He had obviously, a very strong blue jay, had stolen this thing somewhere or found it somewhere and was trying to eat it up in the tree, and it had gotten away from him.
Or he didn't like it.
Or he just decided, let's see if I can hit this guy with a muffin. And he missed. But no, I'll go back and describe that in minute detail. You never know what the one funny thing of that might be. But yeah, I have folders and folders of stuff like that that I'll just note, and you know, sometimes things come of it, but often nothing does.
Ian Fraser's new novel is The Cursing Mommy's Book of Days. Ian, thanks so much.
Thanks very much for having me, Melissa.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.